listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
November 11th, 2017. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola, and I'm broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs. Thanks for joining me today at republicbroadcasting.org. Please also visit and subscribe to spingolaspeaks.net and woolliesblog.blogspot.com and screeningsandyhook.net. During the program, email questions or comments to comment@spingola.email. Do not send questions to my regular email as I do not view them during the program. Please visit the chat room at spingola.chatango.com. You may view our guest lineup at spingola.com. In addition to the links for each guest, I also provide other interesting links relative to the guest and his or her subject. We probably won't take calls until, well, we'll see how it goes, but probably not. Anyway, the Mormon Church claims to have no paid ministry. However, during the 1970s and 1980s, each new member of the Quorum of the Twelve received $1 million. That gift might be substantially higher today. Mission presidents also receive financial support, housing, and all expenses, as do temple presidents who are called out of their usual place of residence. One may also apply that to other high officials. My guest today, and this is going to be relevant, as we shall see, my guest today for the first 2 hours is Mike Norton, N-O-R-T-O-N. He is also known as New Name Noah. He has a YouTube, and you may find that by just typing in New Name Noah YouTube. Now, Mike did an interview on Heart of the Matter, which I've linked on the schedule page, and that was published on October 26, 2017. He's also done an interview with Mormon Stories. I first became aware of Mike when he did a series of videos, which, to an outsider, one might not understand the scope of what he was doing. So today we're going to find out what he's doing, what he's done, and just a bit about his experiences. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Deanna.
Well, it's just great having you on the program. And I've listened to those interviews, and they were very emotional. I could really relate to it. As you know, I used to be a Mormon, and I think former Mormons go through periods of anger and remorse and all kinds of feelings, because nobody likes to be fooled, and certainly there are ways that we can spring back or counteract some of what our experiences have been. And anyway, you grew up in the church, correct?
That is correct. I was born and raised in the church, born in the late 1960s, baptized in the 70s, and went on a mission for the church in the 1980s.
Right. And now, tell us a little bit about a mission. Who pays your expenses? Now, we know that the upper echelon of the church, the hierarchy, they're pretty well taken care of. Did they pay for your mission? Did the church pay for your mission?
They did not. For the most part, I paid for probably half of my mission. A woman by the name of Roxy Marshall, who was like a grandmother to me, paid for the other half.
Okay, but the point I'm trying to make, I suppose, is that the missionaries or their families or friends pay for all of the expenses of that mission. The church does not pay.
That is true.
And
yeah,
in addition,
few exceptions. People pay for the church, pay for their mission themselves. Yeah.
And really, a missionary, I usually now refer to them as the marketers of the church. They go out and they find people to baptize, to bring into the church. They pay their expenses, or the family pays their expenses. And that is in addition to the family also. The family is also expected to pay 10% tithing, and that is on their gross income.
Yeah. Not only are families, in many cases, paying for the cost of their son or daughter to go on a mission, but they are also required to continue giving 10% of their income to the church on top of paying for the mission itself.
Yes. And that's what we did. My son went on a mission, and we thought it was just a wonderful thing. And now I look back, and he had some experiences in his mission that were sort of eye-opening. But tell us about your mission. You went to California, back to pretty much close to where you were, where you grew up, correct?
That is correct. I most grew up in San Joaquin Valley, in a little town called Visalia between Bakersfield and Fresno. Moved to Colorado for a bit and then to Utah, and then I wound up going on a mission. And when I went on a mission, I was actually called to the California Ventura Mission, which covered at the time, this is 1987, a rather wide swath of California that included most of the San Fernando Valley, and went up to San Luis Obispo, and it went out to Bakersfield, and so kind of like a triangular shape chunk of Southern California. And Bakersfield was my very first area. So my first area was, I mean, I don't know how far Bakersfield is from Visalia, but I think it was about an hour's drive away or so. Visalia was actually out of my mission boundaries, but my first area was fairly close.
And you had some very interesting experiences, and you implemented some methods that that I've never heard of before, but I think, except in the early church, when missionaries used to preach to whole congregations, and that's what you did, which is amazing to me. And as I was listening to your other interviews, that is really nice. That is really good. That is an aggressive but a really, I think, effective way of teaching, or at least attempting to market the word.
Yeah, well, keep in mind too, this is, my mission was 1987 to 89, and for all intents and purposes, the internet really didn't exist yet. And so.
Oh no.
Back then, if somebody had so-called anti-Mormon material, it was typically a book or a pamphlet that they either was given to them, or somebody had purchased at a Christian bookstore or something or another and had given it to them. And so a vast majority of people back in the late 80s either didn't know anything about Mormonism, or what they did know was relatively limited. It wasn't uncommon back then. In fact, it still isn't. If you ask somebody what's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear Mormon or Mormonism, they think polygamy. They often confuse Mormons with the Amish, where sometimes they'll think that they're the ones that drive around in little buggies with the horse drawn buggies, and they wear black, right? So I thought as a missionary, that it wasn't uncommon for so-called Christian churches to actually openly discuss Mormonism. And sometimes you'd actually have the minister would actually invite a speaker, somebody like, you know, Ed Decker or Walter Martin, the Bible Answer Man, to come to their church and to teach their congregation. In some cases, there'd be thousands of people teach their congregation what Mormons believe. And I felt at the time, as a Mormon missionary, that the information that was getting out wasn't entirely accurate. In some cases, I felt it was blatantly false. Take, for example, a perfect example, the Godmakers. There was a book out, and there was a movie as well, called The Godmakers. And in my opinion then and now, I thought the book was trash. It was, I felt it was, poorly written. It was poorly researched. And my opinion was that it painted Mormons out to literally be Satan worshipers. It was just absolutely ridiculous. And so I thought to counteract this, starting my very first area, I would take my companion, my mission companion. You always had your companion with you 24 hours a day, essentially, except for, you know, when you're in the shower, you had the bathroom door closed. That was about it. I would take my companions that usually you would have anywhere from a month to 3 months, on average. Usually it's probably about 2 months. We would go to the local Christian, or non-denominational Christian churches. Oftentimes you go to Baptist churches because it seemed like they're the ones that really were spearheading the anti-Mormonism attitude sometimes. So we would go to their churches and just ask them point blank, can we teach your congregation what Mormons believe? We know that sometimes ministers like to teach your congregations what Mormons believe, but sometimes you guys really don't get the facts straight. So could we teach your congregation what we believe? I just kind of felt like the original early apostles for the Mormon church back in the 1800s, they would go off to England on missions to England. Specifically, I remember there was a partnership of Parley P. Pratt and Heber C. Kimball, were early Mormon leaders who went on a mission to England. And they would literally teach, and in some cases baptize, almost entire congregations. And so I figured, if they can do it back in the 1800s, why can't we do it now?
And I think that's wonderful that you were so innovative and that you decided, hey, let's do this. Let's try this out. But what did you do to prepare yourself? You acted like the alternate lawyer who always prepares the case for the other side so that he knows exactly what he's dealing with. And so what did you do to prepare yourself for doing this, for teaching this Baptist congregation?
This is kind of a precursor to what I would eventually do in 2016, but kind of the opposite. This is 1987, as a Mormon missionary, I wanted to get my hands on all of the current, up-to-date so-called anti-Mormon material, but I didn't want to have to pay for it and actually financially support these people that I thought were enemies of the church. So I made some phone calls. I got a hold of Sandra Tanner, Gerald and Sandra Tanner at the Utah Lighthouse Ministry in Utah. Their website is utlm.org. And the Tanners were just a wealth of information. And I gave them my real name, but I told them that I was investigating the church, considering joining the Mormon church, and want to know if they had any information they could share with me that might help persuade me otherwise. I mean, if the church isn't true, I wanted to know it. And so it started with Sandra and Gerald Tanner, where they wound up sending me a couple of books, and they also gave me phone numbers for really all of the other big so-called anti-Mormons. Yeah, they gave me phone numbers for Ed Decker and Dick Baer and Chuck and Dolly Sackett and Walter Martin. And I just started making phone calls to these people. In fact, quite a few of these phone calls I actually recorded, and I'm 99% sure I still have the audio tapes of these conversations.
Michael,
I would call them.
Yeah. Let me just interject something here. The Mormon Church absolutely discouraged It discourages its members from seeking information outside of their, what they have prepared. In fact, the Tanners, we always heard about the Tanners. Oh my gosh, they're evil, they're terrible. Do not listen to anything they say. And being obedience trained, which all Mormons are obedience trained from the time that they're born till the time that they die, to listen to the authorities and to never question. And so you were going kind of outside of what we have been taught by actually reading that evil stuff that the Tanners put out, which is really very good. So go ahead, continue. I didn't mean to.
I didn't. In fact, I actually, well, I wound up getting in trouble for this, cause you're right. For a missionary to be making numerous phone calls to the mean old anti-Mormons and acquiring all this anti-Mormon material, I was very clearly in violation of the mission rules. What I was doing was outside the norm of acceptable behavior.
For every Mormon, not just for missionaries.
Oh, yeah.
For
absolutely.
Every Mormon. Oh my goodness, if you got caught reading something like that, well, what kind of a person were you? So we were all obedience trained. So
I felt like the so-called anti-Mormons were the enemy, and they were the ones that were, in some cases, leading people that I was trying to teach and bring into the church. They would sometimes, or their material at least, would sometimes lead them away, and people would wind up not joining the church because of something they had read. And so
sure.
I became
it
very
was
well-versed in anti-Mormon literature. So, in fact, I actually became somewhat of an apologist on my mission to the point where it was not uncommon for me to get phone calls from other missionaries in the mission with a tough question that somebody gave them. Somebody would call and they'd be like, hey, Elder Norton, I have an investigator and he said that Joseph Smith said there's men living on the moon and they're dressed like Quakers. But you didn't really say that, right? And so I would have to explain to them, well, no, actually, he did say that, and then I would give the rationalization as to why Joseph Smith said that and try to help them. I'd put it into perspective and put it in the context and help them understand why he would say that and why that doesn't mean that he's not a prophet, and then they would go back to their investigator and give them their answer. And I got pretty good at it. I mean, I was a very good little apologist for the church, but yeah, what happened was Dick Bear, who I believe is passed away now. Dick Bear, I believe he was one of the either co-writers or producers of the God Makers, and he was a well-known anti-Mormon. I always say anti-Mormon with like air quotes because I mean, the fact of the matter is, you could take some random talks from Brigham Young from the 1840s or 50s or 60s or 70s. You can take some random Brigham Young talks and just quote Brigham Young directly, and 9 out of 10 Mormons would say, oh, that's anti-Mormon. It's like, well, wait a sec. Okay, I'm literally quoting Brigham Young. And essentially their attitude is, unless it is faith-promoting, it's anti-Mormon. So by that logic, really any encyclopedia set is anti-Mormon because the encyclopedia doesn't support the ridiculous belief that Native Americans were descendants of Jewish immigrants who sailed across the seas and rode around the plains in horse-drawn chariots 2,000 years ago. I mean, some of the beliefs of Mormonism are so absolutely ridiculously laughable, I don't even know where to begin. I mean, they believe that the Garden of Eden, the cradle of humanity, is located in Jackson County, Missouri. That's where life began on Earth. Jackson County, Missouri.
Oh, okay. We do have a 3-minute break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, And our guest today for the first 2 hours is Mike Norton, also known as new name Noah. He does have a YouTube channel. Just search for new name Noah YouTube. Now you were talking about the lack of DNA evidence to support the theory that the American Indian was descended from a small group of people who left Jerusalem, and somehow, well, there was actually two groups, but we're talking about the later group who left Jerusalem and came over here, somehow managed to come over here, build a ship, come over here, and from that very, very small group became millions and millions of people who created chariots, and they had steel bows, they had steel, supposedly, they had all of these wars, and there's not one single archaeological piece of evidence to support that theory. No wheels. Well, there's nothing. Nothing.
There's nothing. In fact, and you know, the although Mormons like to essentially say, well, we really don't know where these people died or where they lived. I mean, we just know they were somewhere in the Americas. And there's been numerous attempts by Mormon apologists over the years to try and pinpoint where these people mentioned in the Book of Mormon actually lived. Joseph Smith and numerous so-called prophets, seers, and revelators over the years have been very, very specific about where some very specific events mentioned in the Book of Mormon took place. For example, there is a hill mentioned in the Book of Mormon, in the Book of Ether, ironically, because it'll put you to sleep. in the Book of Mormon, it tells the story of a group of people called, Jaredites. And, if memory serves me correctly, they came from the Tower of Babel. It was around that time, I believe it was around, I think it was about 4600 BC. It could be, I'm going to say 4600. I'm drawing a blank on that date right now. But thousands of years before Christ, these people supposedly prayed and asked God if he would not confound their tongues and language so they could be together and just leave this whole Tower of Babel nonsense behind them. And they prayed, and God allegedly led them to build what is basically described as submarines. They built submarines, essentially, and they sailed across the ocean to the Americas.
With all these animals and bees and elephants and
honeybees and now some people might say, well,
and with all the food.
Well, yeah. Oh, and all the food and yeah, it's just ridiculous. But those people, those Jaredites, eventually they grew into millions of people. And eventually they had a giant battle at a hill that they called Ramah. R-A-M-A-H. Ramah. And the Book of Mormon says that nearly 2 million, that's a direct quote, nearly 2 million of them died fighting in a massive battle or battles at this hill called Ramah. Well, the hill called Ramah was later referred to as Cumorah by the Nephites and Lamanites. And later, about 1,000 years later, around 420 AD, we are told that a massive battle took place at this hill Cumorah, formerly known as Ramah. And Joseph Smith and numerous other church leaders over the years have pinpointed the exact location of this hill Cumorah, and it was the Cumorah that Mormons are familiar with, that every year they have this hill Cumorah pageant.
Yeah.
And it's also the same hill where Joseph Smith claims that he was led to a set of gold plates that were buried in this hill, and he translated these plates and turned it into the Book of Mormon.
But he never looked at them when he was translating them.
Well, yeah, they didn't need to be in the room at the time. He just looked at his peepstone and his hat. There's a problem with this. So the now, if you in the Book of Mormon,
Mike, we do have a quick 3-minute break. We'll pick this up on the other side. All righty. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest the first 2 hours today is Mike Norton, and we were talking about having to take all that food in these 8 submarines, so that they called them a dish, and they turned upside down, and there was a cork in the top, I could just imagine what a mess it would have been to have all these animals. It was impossible, and all 8 of these contraptions landed at the same place, same time. Now that's a miracle.
Well, I mean, because they were led by God, of course. In fact, my favorite part is. Some people might say, well, wait a second. These are ancient wooden submarines that were made thousands of years before Christ. How did they see? What was their light source inside these submarines? Well, there was a man by the name of Mehanri Moriankamer, Mormons believe, who gathered some rocks and, because he had so much faith, he prayed and he asked God to literally touch these rocks with his hand, with his finger, make them glow, and then he would put a glowing rock on each side of the submarine inside so they could see. So he prayed, and the premortal finger of Jesus Christ reached out of the heavens and touched these rocks and actually caused them to glow. And glow apparently for months and months as they illuminated the inside of these submarines. So they land in the Americas, they populate the Americas, millions of them, at least, about 2 million, according to the Book of Mormon, fought in battle around 600 BC, at the Hill Cumorah in upstate New York. 1,000 years later, about 420 AD, you've got another, according to the numbers given, another 230,000 Nephites, who were a different group of Jewish immigrants and had populated the Americas. They also died in a massive battle at the same hill where the nearly 2 million Jaredites died. So you have a hill in upstate New York, Mormons believe, over the span of about 1,000 years, two massive battles took place in which over 2.2 million people died using steel weapons and armor. Now, to put that into perspective, the Battle of Gettysburg, there was a total of about just over 7,000 deaths at Gettysburg. And if you were to go to Gettysburg today and just start digging, which is illegal, by the way, and you shouldn't do it. But if you did, you would have trouble turning more than a few shovels full of dirt before you would find evidence of a massive battle that took place there in the 1860s. And yet, the Book of Mormon has 2.2 million people dying at and around this Hill Cumorah in upstate New York. They've done excavating there because, first of all, in the 1830s, when Joseph Smith claimed that he found gold plates there, needless to say, people started digging around the hill, seeing if they could find some gold there as well. But the church has also built a temple there, and they've turned the area into a tourist attraction, essentially, for Mormons. But yet, there's never been any evidence found of massive battles. It's not a any some kind of World Heritage site where historians, legitimate historians, have actually pinpointed, holy cow, we don't know what happened here, but we do know that a lot of people died here. That kind of evidence doesn't just disappear in the span of 1,000 years or 2,000 years, but yet Mormons seem to think that it does. At one point, Joseph Smith, when he was still alive, was walking around through Jackson County, Missouri. He stumbled across the bones of a man who was literally laying on the surface of the earth, and Joseph Smith proclaimed that this man, this body, belonged to that of a great white Lamanite warrior named Zelph. So apparently Joseph Smith is stumbling across bodies on the surface of the earth, but yet 2.2 million people die using steel weapons and armor at the Hill Cumorah, and there's zero archaeological evidence to support it. It's ridiculous.
It is. Speaking of other ridiculous things, could you address the Book of Abraham?
Oh, good Lord. go back to 1838. Keep in mind that Joseph Smith lived in a time where, he claimed he was a prophet of God. He translated the gold plates into the Book of Mormon. But back then, Mormons had kind of this, what have you done for us lately attitude. And so he had an opportunity. In 1838, there was a gentleman by the name of Michael Chandler passing through Kirtland, Ohio, where all the Mormons had assembled and were looking. And Mr. Chandler had a traveling mummy exhibit with Egyptian hieroglyphics written on papyrus, and he had like five mummies. And people had never seen anything like this before. People would pay like 50 cents to go inside the tent and actually look at real Egyptian mummies and Egyptian papyrus with hieroglyphics. But they weren't really able to translate hieroglyphics at the time. The Rosetta Stone was found in 1799, and by 1838, there was just a tiny, tiny handful of people in the world that were just mastering the ability to translate Egyptian hieroglyphics. So when this traveling mummy exhibit comes through town, of course somebody asks Mr. Chandler, well, what do these scrolls say? What do those hieroglyphics say? And he said, we don't know. Nobody knows. And somebody, of course, said, well, who could translate that? The prophet Joseph Smith. So, naturally, Joseph Smith is drawn to the display. And Joseph takes one look at one of these rolls of papyrus, and he says, essentially, whoa, holy cow, do you realize what that is? This is the handwritten journal of the prophet Abraham, as in the biblical prophet Abraham. We're talking Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We're talking about the man literally every Christian, Muslim, and Jew in the world believes to be a prophet of God. And Joseph Smith just happens to have this guy's personal handwritten journal traveling through town. Well, needless to say, the Mormons were excited. Oh, we've got to buy this. We have to buy this. So they saved up all their money and scraped and did fundraisers and everything, and they raised, I don't recall the exact amount. I think it was around $2,500, so it was an extraordinary amount of money at the time, because Mr. Chandler said, I'm not going to just sell the papyrus. You've got to buy the whole thing, mummies and all, everything. It's either buy everything or buy nothing. So they bought everything. One of the other scrolls of papyrus that he had in his little exhibit was none other than the handwritten journal of Joseph, who was sold into Egypt, which most people might recognize as, Joseph, the guy with the amazing Technicolor dream coat. So, now the funny thing, the church still has the papyrus. Now, so Joseph Smith translated. He took his sweet time, literally years. So when people would basically say, what have you done for us lately? He could say, don't you understand that I'm translating? And he translates this papyrus that he claimed was written by the hand of Abraham into what is known as the Book of Abraham, which is part of Mormon scripture in a book they call the Pearl of Great Price. But Joseph Smith was killed in the early 1840s. He never finished translating the other scroll, which had the writings of Joseph, who was sold into Egypt. And the papyrus was actually lost. So they thought for years it was lost and burned in the Great Chicago Fire. But it turns out they weren't. And they resurfaced in the 1960s under to a lot of hoopla and all that. And, of course, Egyptologists and experts in Egyptology studied the papyrus, and they all came to the same conclusion.
Joseph Smith was completely full of crap.
His translation of this papyrus, turns out it wasn't written by the hand of Abraham. It was literally about 2,000 years too new to have been written on by the hand of Abraham. And it really wasn't, had nothing to do with Abraham at all. It was a very common funeral prayer, referred to as the Book of Breathings or Book of the Dead. And it was made specifically for the man that was buried with the scroll. His name was, it was spelled H-O-R, pronounced whore. So, but the funny thing is that some of the, hieroglyphics from this papyrus, from this scroll, are actually still in their book of scripture called the Pearl of Great Price. So, and Joseph Smith's translation of these hieroglyphs is still in there as well. So it's just absolutely ridiculous, because since like the 1850s, essentially, there's been people throughout the earth. Now there's probably hundreds, if not thousands of people in the world that can translate Egyptian hieroglyphics, and not a single solitary one of them has ever said that Joseph Smith's translation of the hieroglyphics was even remotely close to being accurate. I mean, not only was it not accurate, it was about as far from accurate as he could possibly be, but yet Mormon apologists will argue that point. I've had Mormon apologists argue that point, and they'll claim that Joseph Smith actually got, you know, he got a lot of things really right, and it was astoundingly accurate. But it's ridiculous. You can't find a single Egyptologist in the world that would agree with that position. But yet they say it, and they say it with a straight look on their face, like, you know, don't call their bluff.
Indeed. Now, and there's some things in the Pearl of Great Price, particularly the Book of Abraham, about black Americans, which was changed quite conveniently in 1978. Would you like to address that, wherein African Americans could not have the priesthood, they could not participate in the temple, because they were somehow, they were second class citizens, and this was in the Pearl of Great Price. And then, of course, Spencer W. Kimball changed it, because this was right at, he changed it in 1978. Conveniently, he got a revelation, and I think it was also had something to do with the fact that, that the government was going to, take away the 501(c) tax exempt status of the church. And there were some other things. It was after the civil rights movement in 1965, so, it's just crazy about some of the dogma that was, that is in the Pearl of Great Price that is still accepted or has been changed, correct?
Yeah, well, one of the things in the Pearl of Great Price is, the claim that our sun, the sun of our solar system, actually receives its power and energy from a star called Kolob. And Kolob is the star that is closest to where they believe God lives. And Mormons in the temple, and generally only in the temple, refer to God as Elohim, which isn't unusual. I mean, I think it's in Hebrew, the original word for God in the Bible is Elohim, which is actually kind of the my understanding is it's kind of the plural term for God. But Mormons refer to God as Elohim in the temple. Elohim lives on a planet closest to the star Kolob, and it also teaches that black people were cursed with the mark of Cain. Now, I grew up in a church where essentially I was taught that Cain, which is one of Adam and Eve's children, Cain killed Abel. And because Cain killed Abel, he was cursed with black skin and would be forced to roam the earth for the rest of the eternities, essentially. So, and it just depends on which Mormon you ask. Mormon doctrine's funny in that, some people, especially the younger people and a lot of the women, don't really know or understand some of the deeper Mormon doctrines. They kind of leave that to the men. So it's not uncommon for a Mormon woman, for example, to be oblivious to the fact that Joseph Smith practiced polygamy. But a vast majority, yeah, a lot of Mormon women think that was Brigham Young's thing. Brigham Young started that, but not Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith didn't marry little girls, but Brigham Young did.
I have a question from the chat, from email, and it relates to this, so let me share it. And I'm going to add a word. What modern day apostle, what married modern day apostle had a different date for every night of the week? And he said the answer is Joseph Smith. Yes, you're right. Most people in the church do not know that Joseph Smith had at least 33 documented wives, many of which were 14 to 17. I think there were 11 that were teenagers. One was Helen Mar Kimball.
And nine of his first 12 wives, when he married them, were already married to other men.
Right.
And so, marry another man. You know, what's fascinating is how many Mormons that do know that Joseph Smith married other men's wives and little girls, they stand firm very often in the belief that these were not sexual relationships. He wasn't having sex with them, which is just bizarre to me, because they don't argue the fact that Brigham Young was having sex with his wives or John Taylor or any number of early Mormon apostles and prophets. They don't argue that at all. But for some reason, they feel like Joseph Smith having sexual relations with his wives is just, that's just going too far. It's just, that's a crazy, wild allegation. You have no evidence to prove this. You can't back that up. And it's like, well, but why? I don't get it. I don't understand why, like, it's almost as if they feel like if Joseph Smith is having sex with his polygamous wives, that would mean he's not a prophet?
Possibly. Okay, we're going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. Alrighty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and we were talking about Joseph Smith and his polygamy, and I believe it was Eliza R. Snow said that when people said a question whether he was having sex with his wives, she said, well, they don't know Joseph very well, those who said that he wasn't. And the fact is that the section 132 talks about polygamy, talks about plural marriage, and it states that you have to get your first wife's permission. And many of the women that he married, his Emma Smith, knew nothing about. And I think she feared for her life at some point. And so anyway, when I read that, I think that was the straw that really broke me as far as being a Mormon. I was just flabbergasted that. And when he married Helen Mar Kimball, he gave her 24 hours. Her father was actually told her, asked her. He said, well, Joseph Smith came to me. He wants to have you for a wife. And he's made all these promises that the entire family would be guaranteed salvation. And she had 24 hours to decide. And there were other times when he would say, tell a prospective wife that there were angels ready to kill him if this woman did not say yes to become his wife. It was just coercion, and he was just a piece of garbage. I never thought I'd ever say that about him, but that's what I think. So, Mike, are you there?
Oh, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So Joseph Smith claimed that an angel of God appeared to him and threatened his life with a flaming sword and told him that if he didn't practice polygamy, he would be killed. In fact, this is an actual quote from an essay that the church posted, and it's on the church's website, where they, let me just read this. It says, this is from the LDS church's website. When God commands a difficult task, he sometimes sends additional messengers to encourage his people to obey. Consistent with this pattern, Joseph told associates that an angel appeared to him three times between 1834 and 1842 and commanded him to proceed with plural marriage when he hesitated to move forward. During the third and final appearance, the angel came with a drawn sword, threatening Joseph with destruction unless he went forward and obeyed the commandment fully. Fragmentary evidence suggests that Joseph Smith acted on the angel's first command by marrying a plural wife, Fanny Alger, in Kirtland, Ohio in the mid-1830s. I believe Fanny Alger at the time was 16 years old. This essay from the church essentially admits that some, it doesn't say all of them, but it does admit that some of the relationships were sexual in nature. It admits some are 14 years old.
Wow. All righty, let's pick this up on the other side of the break. We're at the top of the hour. That's interesting. Very interesting. Be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Back, this is Deanna, and our guest the first 2 hours today is Mike Norton. He is also known as New Name Noah. You can find his videos at New Name Noah YouTube. And anyway, we were talking about Fanny Alger just before the break, and he supposedly married her before the sealing power, which occurred in 1836. Now, Oliver Cowdery called it just a filthy, dirty affair. So, yeah. And he was also fooling around with some of his wife's cousins in Pennsylvania just immediately after they were married. So he was just a philanderer, in my opinion.
You know, what's fascinating is that Joseph Smith, in his lifetime, never actually had himself sealed to any of his own immediate family, his parents and his brothers, and he didn't do any of that, but yet he was supposedly sealing himself to all these women. I find it ironic, talking about polygamy, that a church that is known for their early practice of polygamy and Mormonism still believes that polygamy will exist in the next life. In fact, one of their most outspoken leaders today, Dallin H. Oaks, is actually sealed to two separate wives. This is one of their most outspoken leaders who is thoroughly opposed to same-sex marriage and has spoken against it many, many times. The church is a friend of the court in that lawsuit from the bakery that's trying to prohibit it, trying to get legal to discriminate against people based entirely on their sexual orientation. And the Mormon church is a friend of the court on that. They were one of the largest supporters of the Proposition 8 campaign in California years ago that very briefly made it illegal for same-sex marriage. And yet Dallin H. Oaks, the H stands for homophobe, by the way, he's married to two separate women. He's married to June Dixon. She died in 1998. And then 2 years later, he married and was sealed for eternity to a woman named Kristen McCain. So Dallin H. Oaks, one of the Mormon leaders alive and today, is essentially a polygamist in the next life.
And there are even other people who've done the same thing, other leaders. The other thing that people... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I just appreciate the irony that this church that is so opposed to same-sex marriage and they say, they call it a counterfeit marriage and all that. You just have to appreciate the irony, that a church that is known for its polygamy and still believes in polygamy in the next life is so opposed to anything and would have the audacity to even have the words traditional marriage come out of their mouths. You know, they say that marriage is between a man and a woman, when in reality they believe marriage is between a man and a woman, and a woman, and another woman, and another woman. It's just hypocrisy at its best.
Right. Well, the scriptures, the Doctrine and Covenants, states that they would be married, that a man could only be married to one wife. And that's doctrine. And yet, after the fact, they started practicing polygamy. The other thing, the other excuse, justification, for polygamy, they say, it's claimed, that there were more women than there were men. And so, they were just doing the noble thing of marrying these women, otherwise these women would not have had a husband. And that's just not true. In fact, also regarding this subject, they were importing people from, young women from England to come over here and just for the purpose of marriage in a polygamous relationship. When you look at the history, which a lot of members will not look at the history, they don't read the Journal of Discourses, they don't look at the history of the church, and it's unfortunate.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you want to talk about the CES letter? Or the Kinderhook plates?
Right. Oh, the Kinderhook plates. That's a good one. Okay, so let's go to the Kinderhook plates. In 1842, the Mormons are living in a town called Nauvoo in Illinois. They basically took a bunch of swampland, bought it up, and they turned it into, at the time, was the second largest city in the state of Illinois, second only to Chicago. They had tens of thousands of people living there, and it was a booming metropolis. Well, there's a town about 90 miles north called Kinderhook, Illinois, and a couple of guys decided to pull one over on the Mormon prophet Joseph Smith. So they make these bogus little plates that were kind of bell-shaped, about 6 inches tall, and put some chicken scratches on it and buried them in a hill, and then at nighttime and then during the day they're digging these plates up. And the story was the main guy said that he had a dream 3 nights in a row that there was some ancient records buried in this hill. So he kind of played in the Joseph Smith little thing because that was the thing that Joseph Smith would say. And he finds these plates, and of course immediately everybody's all excited, but they don't know what the plates say. There's strange writing on it. Well, you know who could translate that, of course. The prophet Joseph Smith. So these Kinderhook plates, as they have become known, find themselves down to Nauvoo, Illinois, and Joseph Smith takes a look at them, and he says, and this is almost a word-for-word quote, "I see they contain a record of the man with whom they were buried. He was a descendant of Ham, through the loins of the Pharaoh, and he received his kingdom from the ruler of heaven and earth." And of course, everybody's, "Yay!" He can translate it. You know, a copy of these plates, front and back, were on the front page of the Times and Seasons, which was the local newspaper, the Mormon-owned newspaper in Nauvoo. in Warsaw, Illinois, they had, I think it was called the Warsaw Signal. They wrote an article about the Kinderhook plates and described them as nothing short of a sequel to the Book of Mormon. But Joseph Smith was killed a couple of years later and never really got around to finishing the translation of these Kinderhook plates. But just the fact that he would even make a partial translation and off the cuff, oh yeah, this is what they say, that type of translation is absolutely ridiculous. For about 120 years, the church maintained their position that if only we had these Kinderhook plates, we would be able to prove once and for all that Joseph Smith is a prophet of God, but unfortunately they were lost for forever. Well, not so much. One of those Kinderhook plates resurfaced in a museum in the 1960s, and carbon dating testing was done on them, and linguistic testing was done, and it was concluded, and the church agreed wholeheartedly that the plates are bogus. They were manufactured in the New England area in the mid to early 1830s, and the writing on them was essentially chicken scratches just made to fool Joseph Smith, and it worked. It's just one in a line of bogus translations and failed translation attempts by Joseph Smith, who, I mean, the guy was a professional con artist. And by his own admission, he was essentially a professional con artist. When he was a child, he was a professional glass looker, which essentially meant that he would go door to door and he would tell people that he has a gift and he could tell them where they have buried treasure on their own property, and all they have to do is just give them like 25 cents. Give me 2 bits, and I'll tell you where the treasure is buried on your property. So they'd pay the 25 cents, and they'd start digging, and when Joseph Smith pointed out the spot, you know, he'd put his rock in his hat, and he'd put his face in the hat and look at it, and he would tell them, yep, it's right over by that tree, 10 feet to the left, and they'd start digging, and as soon as they hit anything, a rock, a piece of wood, anything, Joseph would look at his little peep stone again, and he would say, oh no, spirits are moving. They're moving the treasure. You better hurry. And oh, they moved it. I'll tell you what though. If you give me 25 cents, I'll tell you where they moved it to. and you know, this is the 1820s, 1830s. These people would buy it hook, line, and sinker, and they'd give him another quarter, and then he'd tell them where they moved the treasure to. And eventually, after they gave, you know, 75 cents or a buck to him, they'd finally get angry and kick him off their property, and he'd move on to the next sucker. And by his own admission, he made about $14 a month doing that for a living.
And his father was also engaged in that business.
Yes, yes. It ran in the family. Joseph Smith was a professional con artist, but he learned at the you know, at the feet of his father. His father also was a professional con artist. His father belonged to what they call the Fraternity of Rodsmen, where he believed that he had the ability to use a divining rod. And I know that there, I've actually heard of people that firmly, adamantly claim and believe that they have the ability to find water with divining rods or dowsing rods. I don't believe in it, and I don't believe anybody has ever successfully in blind studies been able to prove that they have any ability to find anything with a divining rod. It's like a Y-shaped stick typically that they would hold with both hands, and I believe it was Oliver Cowdery's father. Well, actually Oliver Cowdery had the gift of working with the rod, which that's how it was stated in the original 1833 Book of Commandments. But just a couple years later, they changed the wording and said that Oliver Cowdery had the gift of Aaron, and Aaron being the brother of Moses, who had his, you know, remember his staff that he, right, he would turn into a snake and all that. So Oliver Cowdery claimed to have the gift of working with a divining rod, and Joseph Smith, of course, to soothe Oliver's ego and to keep him true to the faith, actually had a revelation from God telling him that Oliver had the gift of Aaron, or the gift of working with the rod. And Oliver would ask God yes or no questions, and his little divining rod would bob up and down, giving him the yes or no answer to his straightforward questions from God. It's like a walkie-talkie that only has Morse code, essentially. And the person on the other end is God. Pretty cool if you think about it. But of course, it was complete horseshit, you know.
Sure. It's very interesting. You've talked about the Book of Mormon. There have been thousands of changes in the Book of Mormon since its first publication. And a lot of the apologists will say, oh, those are just typographical errors. We just divided it down into paragraphs to make it easier to read. But these were actually doctrinal changes. Now, if in fact, God actually delivered this translation to Joseph Smith, who used a seer stone in his hat, did not look at the golden plates, the so-called golden plates that nobody ever saw, then there shouldn't have had to have been any corrections at all. It should have been perfect right at the beginning, correct?
Yeah. You know, the Book of Mormon, and I'll tell you, although there's been about 4,000 changes made to the Book of Mormon, you know, even as a former Mormon, I can freely admit that a vast majority of the changes made to the Book of Mormon were grammatical changes. There was a few other changes that weren't really grammatical, but and Joseph Smith says that it was the most correct of any book on earth. As a Mormon, I rationalized the changes made to the Book of Mormon because, you know, I felt like, hey, he was translating it from Reformed Egyptian, which is a language that doesn't exist, into English. And, you know, there's bound to be some mistakes, even though God is helping him translate, there's bound to be some mistakes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then how do we explain the thousands and thousands of changes made to the Doctrine and Covenants? Because that wasn't being translated from one language into the next. It was literally the words of God as they came out of Joseph Smith's mouth, and his scribe, oftentimes a man by the name of William Clayton, was studiously writing down what Joseph Smith was saying. But yet, if you were to compare the original Doctrine and Covenants, which is known as the Book of Commandments, 1833, and you can get a photographic reproduction of an 1833 Book of Commandments for just literally for a few dollars from the Utah Lighthouse Ministry in Salt Lake. You can order them online, and you compare the 1833 version to the version we have today, the changes, I mean, there's tens of thousands of changes. In some cases, the changes completely reverse the original intent and meaning of a prophecy or revelation that Joseph Smith gave. In fact, you don't even have to compare it to today's. You could compare the 1833 version to the 1835 version, and you would find thousands of changes made just in 2 years. In fact, that led one of the witnesses to the Book of Mormon, David Whitmer, to basically, he was angry. He left the church. He didn't just leave the church quietly. He was convinced Joseph Smith was a fallen prophet, and he wrote a little pamphlet called An Address to All Believers in the Book of Mormon, which you can also buy from the Utah Lighthouse Ministry, essentially written to members of the church, telling them that, you know, is there anyone that believes, that professes any belief in God, that would believe that this is how God works, that he would give a revelation and then completely reverse the wording and meaning of that original revelation? Is this how God works? Well, yes, that's how the God of Mormonism works. He changes his mind an awful lot. One big change made in Mormonism, somewhat recently in my lifetime, was changes made to the temple endowment ceremony.
Oh yes, let's talk about that.
So when I first went to the temple in 1987, I was 19 years old, and one of the things that we did is we would all raise our hands into the air, and as we lowered them, and then raised them back up again and lowered them slowly, we would chant, "Hey, lay ale, hey, lay ale, hey, lay ale." We were told that is the language. It's the pure Adamic language. It's the language that Adam and Eve spoke in the Garden of Eden. And this was revealed, of course, to the prophet Joseph Smith. And it means, "Oh God, hear the words of my mouth." And during the ceremony, we would also have to, we had what we called penalties, where we would swear an oath that we would never reveal what we were doing in the temple. And rather than do so, we would say, this is interesting. We wouldn't say it. We would have to think it. That we were instructed to think in our minds, rather than do so, "I would suffer my life to be taken." And we would think this in our heads as we were drawing our thumbs across our throats, as if we were slitting our own throats. We would also say, think it again, as we are drawing our thumbs across our stomachs, pretending to slash our stomachs open, and again, when we were pretending to rip our hearts out of our chest. So in 1988, the church put out a survey to about 4,400 members who had been through the temple and asked them essentially essay questions. What did you like about your first experience in the temple?
Nothing.
What didn't you like?
And everything.
People answer these questions. And what's interesting is, 2 years later, in 1990, they made massive changes to the temple endowment ceremony. So now, instead of chanting Pele Ale, you would chant, "Oh God, hear the words of my mouth." And you can watch this on my YouTube channel.
Wow. All right, we'll be back in 3 minutes. Mike Norton, this first 2 hours. We were talking about the, the temple endowment. And, so it was changed. They passed out the survey and then they had a revelation to change it, right? I was dumbfounded when I went to the temple the first time. I thought I was in another world. It didn't seem to have anything whatsoever to do with anything that I had learned at church. It was a terrible experience. Horrible. I can't describe how I felt. And you're not supposed to talk about it outside of the temple. And everyone else seemed so happy for my former husband and myself. I thought, well, it must be me. It must be that I'm just not understanding what has transpired. But it was just the weirdest thing I'd ever experienced.
You know, it's funny how, the temple endowment ceremony, even now, even though they've removed the penalties and you're not chanting, in some foreign language anymore, and you're not being touched all over your nearly naked body in the initiatory, the washing and anointing ceremony, it's still super creepy. But it used to be much worse. I mean, you take the creepiness of it now, you multiply it times 10, and that's what you were dealing with before April of 1990 when they made the changes. But even now, without the weird chanting in a foreign language, they still chant. Just now they say, "Oh God, hear the words of my mouth." It's still super creepy. And it's kind of like a case of the emperor has no clothes, where all the Mormons are telling each other, "Oh, isn't that so beautiful? Isn't it so wonderful? What a wonderful spiritual experience." But yet, if you go to the ex-Mormon subreddit on Reddit, there is a sub called ex-Mormon. Ex-Mormon. Mormon. It has almost 60,000 members of this subreddit. In fact, it is the largest, subreddit of any group of former members of a faith on the internet, on subreddit at least, on Reddit. And if you ask virtually any one of these 60,000 people in the ex-Mormon subreddit to share with you what their real thoughts were the very first time they went to the temple, I'd be willing to bet you that 95% of them would say that it was alarming,
disturbing, I mean, and violent. And
I remember when I first took my wife to the temple. And we got divorced years later, but this is a woman that was the mother of my children. When I first took her through the temple for her first experience, I was 21, she was 20. We went through the whole thing, and we had the penalties back then, so she's pantomiming, slitting her throat, and chanting Pele Ale. We got into the celestial room, and it was just the two of us, and she said to me, "I don't ever want to do that again." And she had like a fake smile on her face and was like, kind of like saying it without actually mouthing the words. Kind of like talking like a ventriloquist, you know. She didn't want to move her mouth. She didn't want anybody to read her lips from across the room and realize what she was saying. And I was taken back. I said, "Wait, what?" And she said, again, without moving her lips, "I don't ever want to do that again." And sure enough, she never did it again. That was in 1989. We didn't leave the church until 2002. And sure enough, she never did it again. I went through dozens of times during those years, but she never went through the endowment ceremony ever again because it was traumatizing to her and so bizarre and so foreign to anything she'd ever experienced in the church. She just had no desire to repeat that, and I can't blame her.
I don't blame her either. She had the courage to say she wasn't going to do it, where most of us probably thought, okay, it's just, I just haven't done it enough. I'll catch on, but I never caught on to it. And I went a lot, but I could never relate it to anything that I'd learned at church. The other thing that bothered me is that even though the name of the church is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, you rarely heard anything about Jesus. It was just all about Joseph Smith and all about all the modern prophets. Okay, we're going to take a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest is Mike Norton. And Mike, you were talking about the temple. Now, not just anyone can go into the temple. Tell us what they have to do, and if they don't do it, they are not. Even parents, if they are not, if they don't pay tithing, they can't attend their child's wedding. So tell us some of the things that you helped people to do to be able to go into the temple. This is funny.
Well, on this subject, I'm sure a lot of your listeners might be familiar with the series on A&E that Leah Remini is doing about Scientology.
Oh, yes.
On a recent episode, Mike Rinder, a guy that was a high-ranking Scientologist who's now a former Scientologist, he made some comment that when I heard it, I can't remember exactly how he said it, but he said something to the effect of that Scientology is the only religion that requires its members to pay in advance for services that they'll receive in the future. And when he said this, and I horribly paraphrased that, but when he said it, I remember thinking to myself, well, clearly Mr. Rinder is not familiar with Mormonism.
Exactly.
In Mormonism, in order to go to the temple, now they have churches all over the place. In Utah, they're on every other corner. There's tens of thousands of Mormon chapels around the world, and those are places where they go to church on Sunday and participate in their services on Sundays. And anybody is welcome. They have signs outside that say visitors welcome. But the temples, there's about 150 Mormon temples spread around the world. The most famous one is the classic historical Salt Lake City Temple on Temple Square in downtown Salt Lake City that was built in the 1800s. And a lot of these temples, most of them, have a gold statue on top of an angel blowing a trumpet. And that's supposed to be the angel Moroni. The angel Moroni is the guy, the angel that supposedly told Joseph Smith where the gold plates are buried that he translated into the Book of Mormon. But in order to attend the temple, you have to pay a full tithe. You have to be a member in good standing. And in order to be a member in good standing, one of the, several of the requirements are, you have to obey the word of wisdom. You can't drink alcohol. You can't drink coffee or tea. You can't smoke cigarettes or chew tobacco. You have to obey the law of chastity, which means you can't be having sexual relations with somebody who is not your legally and lawfully wedded spouse. And I should emphasize that spouse needs to be a member of the opposite sex. You cannot be in a same-sex relationship, even if you're legally married, and be considered to be worthy to attend the temple. You also must give 10%. You must be a full tithe payer, which means you have to give at least 10% of your income to the church for at least 1 year in order to be worthy enough to attend the temple. Typically, in most cases, people go through the temple endowment ceremony where they learn the secret handshakes and passwords that Mormons believe are necessary to enter the kingdom of God, which Joseph Smith, by the way, he kind of stole these handshakes from Freemasonry. When he became a Mason, and literally within weeks of becoming a Freemason, I believe it was a 32nd or 33rd degree Mason, he then created this temple endowment ceremony. And it's really just kind of a bastardized version of the Masonic temple ceremony combined with a retelling of the creation story and of Adam and Eve and Adam and Eve being tempted by Satan and being cast out of the garden and all that. But during the ceremony, throughout the ceremony, you learn special handshakes and passwords that they believe you'll need to know to get into heaven. And when a Mormon gets married in the temple, every single person in attendance at their wedding must be a faithful, tithe-paying member of the church who has already been through the temple ceremony, and essentially everybody in the room is wearing the same special underwear. Because once you go to the temple your first time, that's when you receive, your very first time is when you start wearing the special underwear that they believe are required to wear for the rest of your life if you want to be a member in good standing. And coincidentally, the special underwear that they believe will protect you from the power of the destroyer, aka Satan, these underwear could only be purchased from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So isn't that something that you have to wear special underwear in order to go to heaven, or the Celestial Kingdom, as they call it, but you can only wear these, you can only buy these special underwear from the church itself. And right. It costs about twice as much as regular underwear. Like if you were to buy a six-pack of Hanes or Fruit of the Loom at Walmart, you'd pay about twice as much for your special underwear from the church as you would for regular underwear. A marriage ceremony, a Mormon temple marriage ceremony, is actually relatively short. The actual ceremony itself only takes about 2.5 minutes. In most cases, when a couple is getting married, they will get anywhere from a 10 to 20 minute, pep talk, lecture, call it what you want, from the officiator. The person who is officiating, who is usually a complete stranger to the couple, will give some, words of advice, and those words of advice pretty much always include, make sure you pay your tithing and make sure that you're always worthy to go to the temple. So in other words, pay your tithing and continue paying your tithing for the rest of your life. Then they have the ceremony where it takes about 2.5 minutes. The husband, the wife gives herself to the husband, but the husband does not give himself to his wife. The word love is never mentioned in the actual ceremony itself. And the bride and groom are kneeling at an altar facing each other, but they're not facing each other. During the ceremony, they're required to look at the officiator. And they're holding hands in what is known as the second token of the Melchizedek priesthood, the patriarchal grip or sure sign of the nail during the ceremony. So they're holding hands, they're wearing these outfits that look absolutely ridiculous. They both have on, like, big thing. It kind of looks like a toga. And then they've got a bright green apron around their waist. Both the bride and groom do. They've got this big 6-foot-long sash tied around their waist. And the groom is wearing a hat that kind of looks like a baker's hat of sorts, but it's tied to his shoulder with a string. And the bride is wearing a really ugly
veil
that it looks like she paid, you know, it looks like a $3 veil. It's just, and most Mormon brides are not able to wear the dress. Like if you attend a Mormon wedding reception, receptions are not held inside the temple. So if you attend a Mormon reception, you might actually see bridesmaids and you'll see groomsmen and you'll see this beautiful dress that the bride is wearing. In about 95% of the cases, the dress that you see the Mormon bride wearing at her reception is not the dress she was wearing when she got married, because they're not allowed to wear really fancy wedding gowns or wedding gowns that aren't modest enough. And so most Mormon brides will actually have two separate wedding dresses. They'll have the cheap, ugly one that they get married in, and then they'll have the nice, beautiful one that they wear for their reception. In many cases, the bride's maid at a Mormon wedding reception and the groomsmen, in many cases, didn't actually attend the wedding itself because they weren't worthy. They're either not members of the church, or they drink coffee, or they're too young, or whatever the case may be. It is not uncommon to attend a Mormon wedding reception and have several of the people, the party, you know, the wedding party, the bridesmaids or groomsmen, be people that didn't actually even attend the wedding itself because they weren't worthy to do so. So starting back in 2002, I have helped hundreds of so-called unworthy Mormons attend the wedding of a loved one, usually one of their children. And it's just kind of an underground black market kind of thing for temple recommends. I don't charge a fee for it. In fact, I've actually had people offer. The very first one was a gentleman back in 2002 contacted me and through a mutual friend. He said, I understand you might be able to help my wife and I acquire some recommends. We want to attend the temple wedding of our son. And I told him I could. He said, our bishop wants us to catch up on our tithing. If we catch up on our tithing, then he'll give us temple recommends. But he refused to pay tithing and to catch up because he said that, well, this is back in 2002, he knew apparently how much the church leaders get paid, and he felt like it was abuse of funds. He refused to participate and actually give thousands of dollars to the church, so he was looking for an alternative option to acquire a temple recommend to go to the temple so he could see his son get married. I asked him, just out of curiosity, how much did you give it? Did the bishop give you a dollar figure and tell you, you pay this much and you'll be considered caught up? Yes, he did. It was $22,000.
Wow.
Now, I jokingly said, oh, man, I could do it for five. And he said, well, you take
the trip. Oh, my goodness.
And so there was a little confusion there because I said, no, I was totally joking about that. And he got mad. He's like, wait a second, so you're not going to be able to help me? And I said, oh, no, I can help you. I just won't take your money for it. If I took your money for this, it would make me no better than them. So I'll get you and your wife temple recommends, but I'm not going to take your money for it. I had one person send me a Starbucks gift card for helping them out, but I had another person, I had one person send me a $100 bill one time when they sent the recommend back after using it, they sent it back with $100 and said, here, go buy yourself something. Whatever. If they want to give a gift, that's fine, but I don't ask for compensation for helping them out. I just think that'd be wrong. You shouldn't charge somebody money for the privilege of attending their own child's wedding. And I think it's just wrong. It's ironic that Mormonism likes to say families are forever. Well, yeah, but families also want to see their own kid get married and not have to pay an extortion fee of 10% of their income for the privilege of doing so. And it's sad too, if you have some bride and she's 20 years old and she's getting married, her 16 or 17 year old sister can't attend the wedding because she hasn't been to the temple yet and she doesn't wear the right underwear yet. And so because her younger siblings haven't been to the temple, they can't attend the wedding of their own older sister. It's just ridiculous. And it's sad.
It is very sad.
I refer to Mormonism as a family-dividing, wallet-draining, soul-sucking cult. It's like Scientology light. In that, you know, the only difference between Mormonism and Scientology, honestly, is 150 years. You give Scientology about 140, 150 years, and Scientology will, in my opinion, be much more, they'll be less aggressive, and I think they're gonna fit into society norms better, but the damage has been done. Leah Remini has done such a phenomenal job of exposing, the nonsense that is Scientology that it's got to be absolutely devastating on their conversion efforts and on their convert retention efforts.
Well,
I think what I do is very damaging.
I think what you have done and what you do has been phenomenal. You have helped you have saved people's lives. Tell us about Steve.
Steven. It was several years ago. I had a young man that called me on the phone and he said, is this Mike Norton? I post my phone number online all the time. Anybody wants to call or text or whatever, my phone number, it's 801-971-8661. I want these kids or potential converts in Mormonism, when they see my videos on YouTube, I want them to be able to get a hold of me, and because a lot of times they're angry and they think that I'm lying, that I made them up, that they're all fake. Like I'm the Bruce Wayne of ex-Mormons. Apparently they think that I'm a billionaire and I have money to burn and I am building massive full-scale replicas of Mormon temples in my basement and hiring it's ridiculous. So I want them to be able to get a hold of me and talk so that I can walk them through a very simple process to prove beyond any reasonable doubt that my videos are far from fake. They're very legitimate. So a few years ago, I got a phone call from a kid named Steven, and he said, I just wanted to tell you, thank you. You saved my life today. And I said, how so? I mean, he definitely had my attention. Steven was gay. He'd known he was gay since he was about, I think he said 10 or 11 years old. Maybe younger than that. But the only people who really knew was him, his mom, and his dad. And his parents were divorced, and his mom was very, very Mormon, as was Steven. And when Steven was 11 years old, right before he turned 12 years old, he had an interview with his bishop to become a deacon, to receive the priesthood at the age of 12, which is very customary. And he went in for this interview with a bishop, a worthiness interview, where the bishop would ask him, you know, if he lives the word of wisdom, if he pays tithing and obeys the law of chastity and all that. When he got to the law of chastity, well, before he got the law of chastity, Stephen told me that the very first thing the bishop said to him when he sat down was, so your mother tells me you think you're gay. And he was blindsided by this. He had no idea that his mother had outed him to his bishop. He told me later, if I had a gun, I would have killed myself on the spot. He was mortified. And so what he thought was going to be a 10-minute worthiness interview turned into a 45-minute grilling by his bishop about homosexuality and how, you know, surely Stephen, had some fantasies or touched boys or kissed boys or whatever, and he wanted to know the details. And he was trying to convince Stephen, essentially, you're not gay. You just think you are. This is a phase you're going through, whatever. So Stephen was mortified. But he made it through it. And 2 years later, right before he turned 14 years old, so now he's 13, almost 14, he has another worthiness interview to become a teacher. He's advancing in the priesthood. And he said, if I thought my interview to be a deacon was bad, I had no idea how bad it could get. So he goes into this interview two years later, right before his 14th birthday, with the same bishop.
Oh, dear. Okay, we'll pick this up on the other side. All righty, so Stephen was just about to go into this interview to progress in the priesthood with the very, very same bishop.
He's the same bishop. He's almost 14 years old, and he told me that if he thought his interview at the age of 11, right before he turned 12, was bad, he had no idea. Now he's gone through puberty, and the bishop, for 45 minutes to an hour, essentially grilled him about his homosexuality again and asked him if he lives the law of chastity, and Stephen said yes, and he said, explain to me what you think the law of chastity is, Stephen. And this circular conversation where Stephen had to explain what the law of chastity meant, and you can't masturbate, obviously. You're not allowed to do anything sexual with anybody who you're not legally married to, and certainly not same sex stuff, as Stephen as the bishop assumed Stephen was doing now. He told me, no, he said, I wasn't even 14 years old yet. He said, at that point, I'd never kissed a boy before. I'd never done anything with a boy, but the bishop wasn't having any of it. He was convinced that I was lying to him and kept going, even. And he decided at the age of 14, never going to do that again. Absolutely, positively, never do it again. So a year goes by, he's 15, a few months goes by. He realizes in about 9 months, he's going to be 16 years old, and he devised what he was convinced was a perfect plan to get out of ever having an interview like this again with the bishop. He'd just kill himself. So for 9 months, Stephen planned his suicide. He was stealing Ambien from his mother. Apparently she had Ambien, and he would just take one or two here and there, and after 9 months, he had a pretty hefty pile of Ambien stacked up, and he was going to come home from school early one Friday, take all of his Ambien, barricade himself in his bedroom, lock the door, and he figured his mom wouldn't come home until about, 6 o'clock. She'd make dinner. By the time she called him down for dinner, he'll have been asleep from a giant stack of Ambien for probably hours and hours. He was assuming he would be dead. And right before he actually took the pills and laid down to go to sleep and never wake up, he took one last valiant effort to search for something online that one of the church leaders had said. He wanted to find a talk by a Mormon church leader that was made for somebody like his mother, that he could show them and say, look, brother so-and-so or elder so-and-so says that if your child's gay, you should just love them the way they are, and so on and so forth. He didn't find that talk. In fact, he found a lot of talks that were quite the opposite, things that would probably encourage somebody like his mother. Instead, he found YouTube channel New Name Noah, and he found one of my temple videos, and he's watching it, and he said, I just started laughing. When he realized, he asked me at one point, did you have any bullies growing up? And I said, yeah, sure, in junior high school, there's always bullies. And he said, well, my bullies were my mother and my bishop, and I was done being bullied. But when he saw this video and members, they're wearing these ridiculous costumes and chanting, he knew it wasn't true. He just knew it. He changed his plans. He decided he wanted to live. He wasn't going to kill himself.
Do you want to stay over and finish the story on the other side of 3 minutes?
Absolutely.
Okay. We'll be right back in 3 minutes.
listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest is Mike Norton, also known as New Name Noah. He's got a YouTube channel. The thing about the interviews, every 12-year-old child has to go in for an annual interview, and some of them are pretty rough. Anyway, tell us more about Stephen. What do you think?
When Stephen realized that his mother, his bullies, his mother, his bishop, were members of this silly cult, and he's watching footage of Mormons in the temple doing these handshakes and wearing these ridiculous outfits, he instantly realized that the church wasn't true, that he was being bullied by cultists, literally, and he vowed that it was going to end. Well, Stephen's best friend was gay, and he made it clear to me, he's my best friend, he's not my boyfriend. And Stephen's best friend's mom had told him years before, because she knew his situation, that if he ever needs a place to stay, that he is welcome to stay at their home, and not just for a day or for a week, but for as long as he needed to. She did mention the fact that, okay, you have to be out by the time you're 25, but other than that, there are no limitations. So he packed up a bag, and he waited in the kitchen for his mom to get home, and when she walked in the door, he raises his hands to the air, and as he slowly lowers his hands three times, he said, "Oh, Mom, hear the words of my mouth. Oh, Mom, hear the words of my mouth. Oh, Mom, hear the words of my mouth." And he had a big old speech prepared for her about how dare she, treat him like this, and who give her the right to tell anybody that he was gay and out him like she did. And he just had so much built up. And before he even finished saying, "Oh, Mom, hear the words of my mouth," three times, which is very clearly to her a blatant mockery of what she does and what Mormons do in the temple, he pointed at the door and said, "Get out of my house." And he said, "Gladly." And he grabbed his suitcase that he had packed up, and he told me, "You know, Mike, I know this sounds gay, he says, but I practically skipped to my friend's house." Got to his friend's house, his mom was there, she invited him in with open arms, and so he was sitting there in his friend's room the same day. He shows his friend the video that he saw online of what they do in the temple and all that, and his friend saw my phone number in the comments and said, "Dude, you should call this guy. He saved your life today. This guy saved your life today. Here's his phone number right here." He said, "So that's why I'm calling you. I'm calling you to say thank you. You saved my life today." That was years ago. Stephen's 18 now. I actually heard from him only the second time ever, actually, last July. July of last year, he called me out of the blue and said, "I don't know if you remember me, but a few years ago I called," and as soon as he started telling me the story, I said, "Stephen." How could I possibly forget you, kid? He's very happy. He had a boyfriend. He's going to college. That was not on speaking terms with his mother. He said, "I've never been happier." He's just in a very happy, healthy place now. And Stephen is not alone. There are many, many, many Stephens out there. You know, suicide in Utah is the number one cause of death for children between the ages of 10 and 17, which is unusual. Most states, it's automobile accidents, but the suicide rate in Utah is literally, it's twice that of the national average. And a shockingly high number of those suicides are children that are part of the LGBTQ community. And there's another one online. You just Google Allison Transgender Denver Post. And there is an amazing article about a very brave young woman, a transgendered woman by the name of Allison, who was in a similar situation. Well, not quite as similar as Stephen. Her father's not LDS, her mother is. But she was on the verge of suicide, very depressed, very sad, on the verge of suicide. And one day her brother showed her one of my videos. And the article said, Allison said, it rocked my world. Everything that she thought she knew went out the window, and she instantly realized that the God of Mormonism, Elohim, the exalted man god of flesh and bone, who's polygamist and lives near a star called Kolob, she realized this is not the God that I believe in, and instantly knew that the Mormon church is not true. And it changed her entire outlook on life, and suddenly she became outgoing and wanted to live. And these are just two of what is undoubtedly hundreds of stories. I've had 628 people since 2002 contact me directly via phone call, text message, emails, in person, or whatever, and tell me point blank, because of what you do, I either left the Mormon church or I didn't join, but I almost did. And there is nothing more rewarding than that. Having somebody call me out of the blue, a complete stranger, saying, do you have any idea how much you changed my life with this information and this revelation? My response is, yeah, I got a pretty darn good idea, because I went through the whole thing myself. There is somebody that put some information online that opened my eyes. I think all Mormons have what we call a shelf breaker. With Mormons, when they come across problems with their belief or their faith system, they kind of mentally put this objection or problem on a mental shelf, where they just, you know what, someday we'll have answers, probably when we die. So they just kind of put it on the shelf. And that shelf gets awfully heavy with items that conflict with their faith. And eventually, I think almost all Mormons have some sort of a shelf breaker. There's something that causes that shelf to break and them to realize it's not true. And for some people, it's the way they treat the LGBT community. For some people, it's the fact that the church leaders are paid over $120,000 a year for what they do. For some people, it's the fact that the church spent $1.5 billion on a shopping mall with a multi-million dollar retractable glass roof in Salt Lake City. These are sacred funds. And they may say, well, we didn't use tithing to build that shopping mall. Really? Okay. If you didn't use tithing, it all started with tithing. At some point or another, it was tithing that paid for something, that paid for a business, that made the profits, that made the money, that earned the money, that made that shopping mall. And you have to ask yourself, what would Jesus buy? If Jesus Christ were here today, would he be spending billions of dollars on a shopping mall and use the excuse, well, I didn't use tithing money to build that. That's just extra money that I had from a side job that I'm doing. Really? Is that what Jesus would do? Now, I'm not a Christian. I don't subscribe to Christianity, so I'm not going to pretend to be any expert on Christianity or what Jesus Christ would or would not do, but I am quite familiar with the New Testament, and I have read it, and I think I understand the gospel of Jesus Christ very well. And the gospel of Jesus Christ would never promote or endorse spending billions of dollars on a shopping mall while there are children starving to death in the world. There's just no way.
I agree. Totally, I agree. As you were talking about tithing, I remember reading that Brigham Young never paid tithing. And excuse me.
Not only did he not pay it, he had no problem spending it. He may not have paid it, but he had no problem spending it. Brigham Young spent money that was brought in from the church coffers like it was going out of style.
Right. And it took 40 years to build the Salt Lake Temple, and he kept stringing it out. He would say, okay, we need some money for the windows. So he would have these big campaigns. It was the same as Joseph Smith. You string something out so that you can keep collecting money, money.
They are playing the long con. Yeah, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, all of the Mormon leaders. This isn't a short con. This is a long-term con, and there's a lot of nepotism in Mormon leadership as well. There's a reason why you see the names Smith or McConkie or Kimball come up again and again and again, because they try to keep the wealth in the family. And in many ways, they're really not a lot different from the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints. You know, Warren Jeffs, who's sitting in prison for marrying little girls to other men and stuff. The only difference between Warren Jeffs and Joseph Smith is about 160 years. They're both pedophiles, who fleeced their flock on a regular basis and did it all in the name of God and claimed that they were the prophet of the only true church of God on earth. And a lot of Mormons today don't realize how closely they came to dodging that bullet, because they could just as easily, instead of being born into an LDS family, they could have been born into an FLDS family and been a child of some sister wife, some polygamous sister wife, and they could be wearing little prairie dresses down in southern Utah. It's a fine line between Mormonism and fundamentalist Mormonism, I'll tell you that.
Well, fundamentalism wouldn't exist without Joseph Smith.
No, and there's so many splinter groups. There's a new splinter group that's sprung up by a man by the name of Denver Snuffer, and they call themselves the Remnant Movement. And literally, just within the last few years, 5,000 to 10,000 people have chosen to follow this Denver Snuffer. Some people refer to them as Snufferites. It's amazing to see a brand new Mormon splinter group spring up just over the last few years.
That is amazing.
It is. I mean, you would think the splinter groups are a thing of the past and you're not going to see any new splinter groups, but not so much. Denver Snuffer is, in my opinion, the latest in a long chain of professional con artists who prey on gullible, naive LDS people.
Right.
Sad. So sad.
Now, initially, Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon in order to make some money. He really didn't anticipate beginning a religion, that it just sort of evolved. And he actually sent somebody up to Canada to try to sell the copyright. And the first Book of Mormon said that he was the author. And so the idea of a church just sort of evolved, correct?
Oh yeah. I think the whole thing started as a money making scheme, and yeah, and absolutely, it kind of morphed into a religion. They were unsuccessful, but they did try to actually sell the copyright to the Book of Mormon in Canada, but were unsuccessful in doing so. So I think Joseph kind of stuck it out and was like, you know what, maybe I can. I seem to be having a large following. Maybe I'll just tell them that they need to start paying tithing, that tithing is required. And then it wasn't until the 1840s, the church started in 1830, it wasn't until the 1840s when he created the endowment ceremony. Mormonism is constantly evolving. I think it's fascinating that I went back last year to document new changes made in the temple ceremony, and I went undercover for about 3 months, disguised myself. I used to be a private investigator, and so
yes,
I disguised
myself.
Yes,
tell us about that. Tell us about that.
I don't have much time left, so I've got to go here soon. But
okay.
In a nutshell, they're constantly changing the temple endowment ceremony, not just the endowment ceremony, but other rituals in the temple. And because of these changes, I wanted to go back to the temple and document the changes. And so I disguised myself and attended a local ward in Phoenix, Arizona, actually. And for several months, I attended religiously. I mean, I had a calling in the ward. I had a home teacher. I paid tithing, and I went to the temple a lot. And I documented the entire thing. I actually was recording everything with hidden cameras. On my YouTube channel, I've got a docuseries that I'm still actually in the process of making. I've released 11 episodes. There'll be a total of 14, possibly 15 episodes, and it's called Making of Behind the Veil 2. It kind of speaks for itself. You'll watch the videos, starting with episode 1. I've got a playlist on my YouTube channel. Just click on the playlist and watch through them. Some of the episodes are 6 or 7 minutes long. There's at least one episode that's nearly an hour long, but most of them, on average, I think they're about 15 minutes long. And it just kind of walks you through the entire 84-day experience that I had last year, where I, for the first time in 15 years, went back to the Mormon Church and participated in all the ceremonies and rituals and all that in an effort to document the newest, latest changes made in the temple. And it was quite an experience, to say the least. Nothing quite like being out of Mormonism for 15 years and going back inside. I tell people when they ask what I do, I tell people, although this is not what I do for a living, I tell people I'm a documentary filmmaker. And I describe myself as kind of like the Leah Remini of Mormonism, but I'm not famous and I'm not rich. And instead of writing a book like Leah Remini did and interviewing members, I strapped on multiple hidden cameras and went back into my cult, Mormonism, and documented the creepy, weird stuff that goes on, and posted it online. I wish Leah Remini would have, she certainly has the budget. Leah Remini could have disguised herself and went back into Scientology, and documented the abuse and the creepy rituals, but you know, she has her own little style, and I think it's very admirable. But I have a bit more of an aggressive approach to Mormonism than Leah does with Scientology. But I think we both are very passionate about exposing the cult that we grew up in.
And for that, many, many people are grateful. And the other thing that you pointed out in your series, supposedly Mormon leaders have the spirit, they have perception, and they can tell when a member is lying or being deceitful. And you totally expose the fact that, nope, they do not have the perception that they claim. And I think Richard Lyman proved that when he was living with a plural situation for, was it like 25 years? And he was an apostle, and even his fellow apostles did not realize it, that he was, that he had a plural wife. And this was from 1920, to 1945. And so you really have to say, gosh, they really don't have the spirit, or they would notice these things. They would be able to perceive these things. And you certainly prove that.
Yeah.
As well as other things.
They call the power of discernment. They believe, especially bishops. Bishops, according to the Doctrine and Covenants, are blessed with the power of discernment so that they can discern the intentions of people. And part of the reason why I did what I did last year was to push the envelope as far as possible. I wanted, on the power of discernment, I wanted to prove beyond any reasonable doubt that if there is the power of discernment in Mormonism, you sure can't find it, because not a single solitary person throughout the entire process. And I keep in mind, I recorded with multiple hidden cameras my worthiness interview for a temple recommend with the bishop, with the stake president. In fact, in one episode, I think it was episode 10 or 11, I actually have on the screen a lie-o-meter and a discern-o-meter to kind of jokingly keep track of how many times I lie and how many times the stake president actually calls me on my lie and says, oh, you know what, I don't feel like that's truthful. Now, he just hands me a temple recommend. And let's just say that it was the final score on the lie-o-meter and discern-o-meter was kind of a blowout, and he was not on the winning side. But, yeah, it's fun stuff. Definitely go to a YouTube channel, New Name Noah. Click on my playlist, and there's a playlist for the Behind the Veil series, and you can watch all 11 episodes. I'll have episode 12 coming out in the very near future, probably within the next week. It'll be a longer episode because episode 12 is going to cover day 77 out of 84 days when I taught the high priest group.
Oh. Wonderful.
Fun stuff.
Wonderful. Well, I certainly do appreciate you being with us today, and I know that you have to go, and thank you very much for staying over. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
All right.
Have a good one.
You too, Mike. Bye-bye. Okay, we'll be taking calls, so call in with questions. Louisiana. And we'll take your calls at 800-313-9443. Mike had to leave. He was actually only going to be able to spend 2 hours with us, but he did stay on for some extra time. I would like to just reiterate that I believe that Michael Collins Piper wrote the very best and most comprehensive book on what functioned as a public execution of John F. Kennedy. Okay, let's take Chris near Las Vegas. Chris, welcome to the program.
Well, hello there, Deanna, and what a distinct pleasure it is to speak with your lovely self again.
Well, thank you. And happy Veterans
Day. I really admired Michael and his work and his investigative research in exposing some of the fraud of these legions of men who like to usurp the alleged powers of the Creator and claim that they are the dispensation of the will of the Creator on this planet, when they really are just imposters and trying to prey upon the people's weakness and their belief systems and their desire to find some link with something they can see that's tangible to give substance to their belief system.
Do you realize that the Mormons pretty much funded the casinos in Las Vegas? Are you aware of the early history of Las Vegas and how the Mormons impacted that area?
Oh, absolutely. They were on their way to Salt Lake from different areas of the planet, and they located it here because there was water sources at the Meadows, which is what Las Vegas means. In fact, it's very curious. There was also an area up close there and up near Cedar City and St. George where they had the Mormon Massacre when they donned attire or costumes of Indians and attacked some of the westward settlers who they feared was threatening their Mormon way of life.
Well, that had more to do with blood atonement than any kind of a threat. The blood atonement is something that was created or perpetuated by the death of Joseph Smith. They decided that they were going to get even with people, and so anyone from any of the area, and also Parley P. Pratt, another Mormon, he was an apostle, was killed. And he was killed, I believe it was in Arkansas. And so anybody from Arkansas, excuse me, anyone from Arkansas was a target. It didn't matter whether they had anything to do with it or not, which is kind of unusual because one of the 13 articles of faith is that we believe that man will be punished for his own sins and not for Adam's transgression, which would also imply that people will be punished for their own sins and not for what somebody else has done. But the church was really into blood atonement. And they said that there were certain crimes that were committed that the atonement of Jesus Christ did not cover. And the only way that they could be atoned for would be if a person killed themselves or allowed themselves to be killed, or as a revenge tactic, such as what we know about with the Mountain Meadows Massacre, where at least 120 people, including children, were slaughtered. And it was the Mormons, and it was Brigham Young knew about it. He knew about it, and Albert Smith knew about it and participated in it. It was nothing happened in Utah that Brigham Young did not either acquiesce to or know beforehand or allow.
That's rather interesting. I hadn't observed and put together that Parley P. Pratt was killed in Arkansas, but I guess that kind of one-ups Hillary Clinton being the first ones to commit arsonicide, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, the reason that he was killed is that he decided to take another wife, and so he married somebody that was already married. And it was her husband that actually killed him. And just as an interesting side note, my grandfather was named Parley P. The last name was Taylor, but he was named after this apostle, as were a lot of other people.
Huh. That's very curious. You've got so many little secrets to your life that we don't usually hear. Thanks for sharing that with me.
Well, I've
done some research.
Anybody that wants to call in and ask me a personal question about this, I'll be happy to answer. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I had also cognized on my own due diligent research and reading some of the former prophets that had left the church and discovered that the early foundational core members of the Joseph Smith entourage were all, in fact, 33rd degree Masons or Masons, as we know them.
Well, not all of them. His brother Hiram was a Mason. There are some claims that his father was a Mason. Heber C. Kimball was a Royal Ark Mason. So there were a lot of people who were Masonic. And, that's why the Masonic ritual became a part of the temple endowment. In fact, it became a part of the temple endowment after Joseph Smith joined the Freemasonry.
Well, it's very unusual, and I don't think it's without some foundational coincidences that I had discovered a very dark cult of satanic child pedophilic murderers and sex abusers up in that Salt Lakes area near West Jordan and American Fork, Utah in particular. I think they very much operated throughout the whole Salt Lake Valley. And this is when I discovered the FBI was pretty much deeply involved in this sort of stuff too, or at least elements within. I think I hear music.
I don't hear anything.
Oh, okay.
But maybe they forgot. Okay, so great if they forgot.
Thank you.
Okay. Regarding the I guess Chris hung up. All righty, let's take J.R. I was going to respond to Chris with the Glenn L. Pace, one of the members of the presiding bishop, wrote a report. He interviewed some 60 people and about the pedophilia and about satanic rituals. And of course, it never came to anything because most of the judges and the legislation in Utah is pretty much controlled by the Mormons. And in the temple, you pretty much devote yourself to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and to building up the kingdom of God. And just as in Freemasonry, you don't tattle on your fellow Masons or your fellow Mormons. Okay, so let's take J.R. in California. J.R.?
Hi, Deanna.
Hi.
Hey, really enjoyed the show today and appreciated Mike. He's from my hometown.
Really? And, isn't he terrific?
Yeah. I actually probably either went to one or the other of the Mormon at that time they were called Stakes. There in Visalia, it was the corner of Tulare and Conyer, and was made familiar with the Mormon religion. And my best friends, the way I got involved, were they were all my high school friends. And, you know, we started hanging out together and stuff. And Mike is the first person that has ever mentioned anything that they taught me back in those days, which was that the early Mormons were very mechanized and understood machinery and had built all kinds of different machinery themselves. And any other missionaries and any other Mormons that I've come into contact with have never been offered that knowledge, and it was like, you know, it was a revelation to him. I was curious. I was hoping I could speak to him regarding that.
Yeah, he was only going to stay for 2 hours because he had another obligation. But he did stay over a little bit longer than he planned to, for which I'm grateful. With the Mormon Church, they will use the skills of the members to the max. There's a lot of free labor involved. There's a lot of game preserves that the Mormons own. There are just all kinds of businesses. For instance, the girls' camps that were started under the jurisdiction. Well, there's always been girls' camps, but when Susan Tanner was the president of the Young Women, they bought just dozens and dozens of properties for girls' camps. And the maintenance during the year, because they have to be maintained during the year, and all of the work is done by volunteers who are called on a mission to do what they do. And they don't get paid for it. In fact, they pay their own way. And some of the buildings have been built. For instance, the Polynesian Cultural Center was mostly built from volunteer labor. And the people that participated there were doing it on a volunteer basis, except for the managers. And yet it is a for-profit industry. And when you look at the for-profit industries, and Mike did mention City Creek Mall, that is a for-profit industry. Now, under the way that they financed that mall is that they paid cash. And when you pay cash, under certain circumstances, if you're a 501c3 corporation and you declare you're a nonprofit, because they paid cash for the mall, all of the people that lease the stores, whether it's Nordstrom's or whomever, all of the people who are leasing in that particular in City Creek Center, all that is non-taxable. The church does not pay any tax on that. So, and they also build a lot of apartment complexes in and around the mall. And of course they sold those. So the church is really not a church. The Mormon Church is a corporation.
And you know, like the United States government, same situation.
Absolutely.
By the way, they still own a large degree of either, what was it, Coke or Pepsi?
That I'm not sure, but they just recently started selling Coke at BYU. Now, when I was a member, we never drank Coke because it was not, I wouldn't drink soda anyway, but Coke was a no-no. But now it's okay. And I would not be surprised if they didn't own stock in it. They own stock in a lot of things.
Back in the day, that was the whole thing. I mean, it was kind of like, I was asking my buddy, he said, wait a minute, how come Coke owns, or the Mormon Church owns stock in Coke, and they forbid you to drink it? Oh, and then it was kind of like Mike was saying, all of a sudden things change.
Sure.
Oh, it's okay to drink Coke now.
Right.
Cool.
Well, see, the whole word of wisdom came about in a very interesting way. In the School of the Prophets, which was in Kirtland, they met up in the upper room, and the Smiths were living on the Whitney property. If you look at the history, you'll see that they always seem to be living with someone. Anyway, the School of the Prophets met upstairs, and after the meetings was over, Emma would have to go upstairs and clean up all of the tobacco and all of the I guess they chewed tobacco and they would spit on the floor. Pretty gross. And she didn't like having to clean it up. And so she complained and she said, it's too bad that there couldn't be a revelation against smoking. And then, kind of, just getting even with her, or as a respond to her, the guy said, yeah. So, and then we'll have to say that the women can't drink tea or coffee, which they really enjoyed. So the whole thing with the word of wisdom really started as kind of a joke or because of Emma's complaint. And there were a lot of groups already, in the area that were saying.
Like a short story. Emma's complaint.
Yes. Yes.
That would make a wonderful short story.
Well, David Whitmer talked about this. He wrote about
Emma's
this.
Complaint. Oh,
and, yes. And that's how it started. But there were, temperance, organizations all around there that were saying, okay, don't eat a lot of meat, no coffee, no tea, no smoking, no liquor. So it wasn't as if Joseph Smith came up with this new health law that was any different than what they were already preaching in the area. And yet, to hear Mormons talk about it now, it was as if it were a brand new thing. Wasn't he wonderful and he was before his time? No, he really wasn't. It started out as a joke, and that's what we have. And the church,
story about the plates. That was too good.
Right. And the church really didn't start living the word of wisdom until the 1900s, probably 1920-ish. And Brigham Young owned a distillery. They had a bar in the Hotel Utah. In fact, they got a loan, a $2 million loan from the Eastern bankers, Bernard Baruch, to build the Hotel Utah. And the only way that they could pay it back within 2 years, which was the stipulation of the loan, is that, they decided that they would put a bar in the basement.
I'm surprised they weren't running prostitution.
Well, polygamy pretty much would fall under that. And as far as polygamy, many of the women, that I've read about actually were just pretty much slaves. Webb, Eliza Webb, she was put in charge of one of Brigham Young's wives. She was put in charge of one of his farms. And she had to really work very hard. Her mother helped her, and they were furnishing cheese and other dairy products, milking cows and everything else. They were furnishing dairy products, for the Beehive House and for the other families. But she was working herself to the bone. And she got absolutely no support from Brigham Young. So, if you look into the stories of how the women survived, especially when their husbands were called on missions, a lot of them were just left to fend for themselves. So, anyway.
Well, Deanna, the question that Ed, and I don't know if you can help me with this. I would be very interested to get Mike's phone number. And by the way, have you ever heard of a guy by the name of Bill Schnevelin?
I have. I think I watched a video that he did.
Is he the person that was a occultist and was told by the...
I think so.
And he was told by the high occultist, if you ever have a spiritual problem, go to the Mormon temple in Salt Lake City. And when Mike mentioned the, curse of Cain, supposedly Cain is living there underneath Salt Lake City, according to Bill Schnevelin.
Yeah, that's a little far-fetched.
Well, I don't know. It makes a good story. Anyway, thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you. Alrighty.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Mike did give his phone number. At the end. So, JR, if you're listening, and also if you visit his YouTube channel, you would probably find his phone number there. So if anyone has any questions or comments about Mormonism, I'd be happy to answer them, whether it's personal, from my own life, experiences with the church, or if you'd like to talk about Veterans Day. Veterans Day is, I do not celebrate Veterans Day. When you think of the things that have occurred, and I was talking to my son earlier today, and we were talking about Veterans Day, and how many people are slaughtered, literally slaughtered in other countries, and people get recruited or join the military without any idea about what they're going to experience. And many of them come home without their limbs. They come home with post-traumatic stress disorder. A lot of them come home and are put on psych drugs. And there are 22,000 former veterans who commit suicide each year. Now, that's a very large number. So, anyway, if you want to call in, it's 800-313-9443. A little bit about my story, how I became involved with Mormonism. I was actually born into it. Now, my mother was, start with my grandparents. My grandparents, one of them was first generation, from England, and my grandmother was from Denmark. Her father practiced polygamy. He worked on the Logan Temple. He was a carpenter. He was jailed with John Taylor. He actually was hurt. A door fell on him when he was a carpenter at the Logan Temple. And anyway, so I was born into it. My mother got married when she was relatively young. My grandfather, Parley P. Taylor, he drank a lot. And he was pretty brutal to my grandmother. And so they left the rest of the family, and they moved to Nevada, where her brothers could not retaliate for his brutality to my grandmother. But anyway, my mother got married very young. She was only 15. And she was, I think she was very traumatized by her family, her life. And anyway, she also drank. She was an alcoholic. I guess if somebody drinks every day, they're an alcoholic. And so anyway, she was not active in the church. She would be considered a Jack Mormon. And when I was 9 years old, and I had an older brother, my mother didn't like having her kids around during the summer. And so we usually got shipped off to our relatives. We were living in California at the time, in Sacramento. My parents shipped us off to Nevada to our aunt, and we just loved staying with our aunt and uncle. It was wonderful. I used to ride bikes up into the hills, and it was just a really great. And my aunt always made cookies, and she was just a really, really great aunt. I just really loved having her. Anyway, while I was there in Nevada one summer when I was 9, my grandmother had remarried after my grandfather died. He died very young. He died at the age of 52. And so my grandmother had remarried, and her husband baptized me and my brother. And that's how I got baptized. And then I became a member of Record, so that when I went back to Sacramento, the records were sent to Sacramento, and so I was on the records of the Mormon Church. Okay, let's take a phone call from Susie in Arkansas. Susie, welcome.
Hi, Deanna.
Yes.
I have a question, and my sister is a Mormon, and I'm not happy about it. I can't imagine people, as you were talking about it during your interview. And I was wondering, is there any way at all that I can say something or ask her a question that would wake her a little? I hate to see her. She works so hard for her money and to give all that to the church that doesn't give a darn about her. And I know that the people who join the church, I know they're lovely people. It's the hierarchy.
The members are wonderful. The members are just wonderful. The problem is that, the appeal of Mormonism, and it was the appeal back in the 1830s, is that Mormonism answered all the questions, and it was created in a puritanical kind of an environment, and it answered questions that no other church was addressing. Where did you come from? Why are you here? Where are you going? And so it has a great deal of appeal. Now, is your sister married or single or?
And again, I have no idea how she's been able to do this, but she has been married. 1, 2, 3, 4. 4 different men, and one of them 3 times.
Wow.
How does she do that and still be in good standing with the church?
I don't know, because I don't know.
It just amazes me.
Yes. What you should do is probably suggest that she read the CES letter. CES letter.
I begged her to read some of the information that is not pro-church. But, you know, she believes in the authority.
Okay, hang on. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and we still have Susie on the phone. Susie, I would recommend that she read the CES letter. All you have to do is, in fact, I'll post it on my schedule page. But if she just uses a search engine and put in CES letter, and it's a PDF document, it's about 72 pages or so, and it has a lot of very interesting information. As Mike was saying, everybody has things that kind of bother them, and they just put them up on the shelf, and just, you know, it's something that you can deal with, and maybe you'll learn about it later. And as I was a Mormon for a very, very long time, and I would, these things would crop up, and I would just say, well, it's just my lack of understanding. It must be me. But when you really look at the history, and I'm a history buff, and when you look at the history, you just can't refute the history. And I think probably my shelf breaker was the polygamous activities of Joseph Smith. I just do not believe that a 37-year-old man who is already married and who lies to his wife and lies to the public and says, no, we're not practicing polygamy, and then marries a 14-year-old girl, that was my shelf breaker. That's pedophilia. So there might come a time when your sister might have a shelf breaker. But everyone has to come to their decision on their own, what it's going to be. The other thing is the corporate nature of the church and the money that is spent, the land that is owned. It's beyond anyone's imagination. They are in so many businesses. They're big cattle raisers. Here they're talking about eating meat sparingly and only in winter, according to the 89th section of the Doctrine and Covenants. Yet they raise more cattle than just about any other entity in the country. And so you have to ask, what's the deal? And when Gordon B. Hinckley was on, I believe he was on 60 Minutes, he was asked about polygamy and said, oh, that's something you do. That's in the past and we don't do that anymore. But in fact, it is still in the scriptures. And he knows better than that. He knows it's in the scriptures. And so there's lying and there's just concealing the truth. And both are not very good.
It would seem to me that the Mountain Meadow Massacre would be a shelf breaker.
That was a shelf breaker for me also. When I've read a couple of books on the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and it was tear-jerking, absolutely. And the other thing, the hand carts. That was just the hand carts, the people who suffered during the hand carts. Oh, my gosh. That was to save money, to save money. Thank you, Susie, for your phone call.
Thank you, Diana, for all you do.
Thank you. Thank you, listeners. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye. Take care.